Okay. Now, we kind of talked about this already. I was going to have a discussion about some common symptoms of false beliefs that we have in our society today, which lead people into addiction. How do we consent to sin? Is our silence a form of consent to sin? And what values do we need to have in order to avoid addictions? There is such a thing as what Roger was talking about normal use of certain things. You know, it's a little bit of some things, or most things won't hurt us. But some things are more dangerous than others. And there are rational drinking guidelines, about people drinking about too much. Okay. Now, does anyone have any comments or anything about this?
I think on the last question about avoiding addiction is, the safety net of people around you is probably a big factor in not progressing from one stage to another. That if you have a safety net around you, that it can arrest something before it gets worse.
Yeah. Yeah, social support is very important, and it's really why they say that if you don't want your kids to use alcohol or drugs or to abuse alcohol or drugs, the best prevention measure that you can take is to communicate with the kids. Okay, you got to be talking to the children. You got to be talking about their day. You need to be talking about who their friends are. You got to be talking about their fears, their ambitions, their desires, their relationship with you, the relationship that they have with God. Okay. Now, what's going on in that kid's head? Okay. And as a parent, you have to take the time to do that. And oftentimes, parent, we live very busy lives. Okay. And we don't really take the time to spend time with our kids that we should. And it's really the most important thing we can do is to talk to our kids. But that's that social net that you're talking about. Okay, but you can't wait until they're 17, 18, 19 years old and then have a discussion with them about what they're doing. Because by then, they've already made their mind up what they want to do. Okay? We want to get them going in a good direction, when they're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. Okay, because once they get past about 12 or 14, it's much more difficult to talk about. Although you still can. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Just to touch on the false beliefs thing again, one of the sisters mentioned it earlier, but I'm 34, and about 10 years ago when I was in my mid to late 20s, I noticed with the younger, not a generation younger than me, but with people a few years younger than me, going to inpatient rehab all of a sudden became like the in thing to do. And so these kids seem to, from my perspective, seem to think, oh, I can go out and, do cocaine or, drink or whatever, and it'll be okay because I'll just go to inpatient rehab and, that's the in thing to do right now, and then everything will be okay after that. And then, I still see those people 10 years later who have been to 8 inpatient rehabs, and, it wasn't good after that. And so, I know that when I was in school, we got a lot of, I went to school in like the 80s, 90s when, say no to drugs, it was like a big thing. But are they still doing a lot of drug education in elementary school and early junior high? Because these false beliefs seem to be from, like you said, a young age. If you don't get them at a young age.
Well, the kid I was talking to this morning, I mentioned that he's been in 17 inpatient treatment programs. Oh, seriously? Yeah. I cannot honestly say I know exactly what they're doing in the public school system over here. I'm sure that there are some schools that have better programs than others, okay? But at the same time, I will also tell you that the child will listen to the teacher, and they'll read those pamphlets, but they need to have a parent. They need to have somebody in the home talking to them about those pamphlets. Okay, the best thing would be that, take this home and talk this over with your father, or talk this over with your mother, okay, talk this over with your folks, okay? That's the best thing. Unfortunately, many kids don't have a father or a mother, or they're in a home with addiction exists and things like this, so it's a difficult thing. the schools can help some, okay, and some of them I'm sure are doing a good job, you know. But they really need to have from the home, and we're trying to get them to do it. Yeah, we have priests over there who are putting our flyers in their churches, okay, because they don't have halls over there. We have, so most churches don't. They're trying to build them, but they cost money, so there's not too many of them. But no, the priests recognize over there that they have a central role to play in the life of the youth, and so the schools are important. Yeah, but they're certainly not the only thing that's going to help. Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah.
In your second paragraph, is silence a form of consent? In catechesis, for instance, in discussing the mysteries and penance and its importance, how would you approach, or how would you suggest that in with catechumens, how Orthodoxy in particular addresses this part of our spiritual experience, so that they know that within the church it's a community of healing and support?
Well, I'm not exact. I think that for me, it's a process of becoming. Okay, and if the priest has kind of gone over the basic doctrine and the important tradition of the church, then I believe that the catechumen would understand his responsibilities to himself and to God. Okay. Now, beyond that, I think that the person will develop a better understanding of that over time. So it'd really be after the, if before the person comes into the church, it's really kind of an intellectual thing. It's more like a decision thing, although it's in the heart too. Okay, but the real development of our Christian self happens after we come into the church, because then we're active in the sacramental life of the church, and then we start a process of personal honesty, of confession, of communion, of repentance, so to speak. Of reading, of knowing, of understanding, of trying to, you know, to really understand better our place, you know, in this world, in life. You know. Just, I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Well, especially since some of them come to Orthodoxy or come to the church because of this struggle,
Yeah.
How we can direct them to the advantages of being in an Orthodox community.
Well, I think it's, you know, now I was brought in just after Pascha, and I guess just after Pentecost, excuse me, because I came into the church one Sunday morning, and it happened to be the Sunday of the publican and the Pharisee, you know. And I thought, well, you know, okay, I like that. That makes sense, you know. And then the next Sunday was a prodigal son, and, you know. Yeah, I'm pretty prodigal, you know. So it just, you know, for me, it was a natural fit, you know. And and the priest, you know, he gave me books to read and all this kind of stuff. I think just, you know, they really have to go through the liturgical life of our church. If you go through the, I forget what it's called, where just the liturgical year. Okay, it's a whole process of coming to know God. And I suppose especially looking at the periods of time that we have in our faith for repentance and for examining ourselves and for, you know, for deepening our spirituality and our relationship with God, and teaching them especially about those times. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's kind of a strange question here. There's this gentleman here was talking about how alcohol actually worked for him.
Yeah.
And even in a dependent state, there must be some benefits to it.
Yeah.
You know? And I also was thinking, suppose and there was no dependency in the use of alcohol, what would it do for us spiritually? Would it be a bad thing or would it be a good thing? In other words, if you didn't have to deal with dependency and you just gleaned the benefits of alcoholism, does that take you away from God?
Well, I think anything, any kind of activity that we use that detracts us, okay, from God is probably not such a good thing. I think living in the world, you know, there are many people who use alcohol and they use it wisely and they benefit from it, they profit from it, and that's a good thing. Alcohol, see, we're not anti-alcohol or even anti-drug necessarily, okay, but it's a matter of degree. Okay, it's a matter of how it's used. More importantly, it's a matter of what it does to the person. Okay, because some people will, you know, they may have a more broken broken personality. They may have a deeper spiritual struggle than another person.
Well, I've lived long enough to know people who are better off drunk than sober. They would have done a hell of a lot more harm sober. Now, for example, if Stalin, who made Hitler look like a choir boy, he was highly disciplined to get to where he was. He'd have been better off dead drunk in some train station in the police. You know,
yeah, so would everybody.
That would have been a benefit of alcoholism, you know, looking at it.
Well, but he may have been a functioning alcoholic. It's very possible. There are some alcoholics that actually function pretty well.
Sibelius
is
one.
Yes, yes.
I'm hesitating because I don't have any children. I've been sober a long time, but that's unimportant. What I know is that I live in a neighborhood with people who. Do I necessarily agree with their lifestyles? No. Do they know and see me as their judge? No. Do they know that I love them the way they are? Yes. Do they see me go to church? Yes. All I'm saying is that in my little world, in my little life, I walk the walk. However, once my neighbor had a sister-in-law come and visit, and she refused to come out of the bedroom, and she stayed drunk. And so Jim and I knew what to do. And we told the family, this is what you do, and they called the police, and they gave her a choice, and it's great. You can either go in this jail over here, or you go to this program.
Yeah.
She picked the program. She's sober today, not because of us, but anyway. And also, I am telling you that I had a drunk cousin who called me, and he's babbling on the phone, and I'm not a cruel individual, but when I got to talking to him, I told him, I said, you know, Jerry, I'm going to count to three, and I'm going to hang up. I said, I love you, but the next time you call me, you call me sober. And I counted to three and I hung up.
Yeah, I don't talk to people if they're drunk. I'm the same way. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Anyway, but it's my walk and my interaction and my lack of judgment for people who are different to me, whether they go to church or not, they see me go to church. I don't care what they, my brother thinks that I'm some religious somebody, but I don't care, and I love him just the same, you know, and he loves me, but I walk this walk. But I'll tell you, if you ever want to know about what to do to help a person who is, you know, stuck in the use of alcohol, I know what to do. My husband and I know what you
do. Thank you. Now, Jerry, did you have something to add to that? I know you had your hand up. No, did you had your hand up.
I may have been scratching my head.
Oh, okay. I thought you were.
I would add something to what my wife was saying. We spent a little time in Siberia, in Krasnoyarsk, and it was a major problem there with alcohol. And then a little bit of the poppies that come from the south there, and just above Mongolia and so forth. One thing I noticed immediately when we were there, that we talked to mostly Christians, that Christians, and not necessarily any particular denomination, but Christians there, and it could be part of the culture, is if you say you're a Christian, you are to go out of your way to help anybody for anything. And what we found and what we helped to do was break down the system of, if you're calling yourself a Christian, and then they would be accused of that, then you have to help me. And I, at one point, there was the wife and the husband were about to separate, or she maybe, every time he goes out and gets drunk, she would kick him out of the house because they had the children and so forth. And then he would say, okay, I'm ready to stop drinking now. And so as Christians, they would go and get him wherever he was and bring him home. Okay? And what was very difficult to do was to get them to say, no, when he does that, and he's ready to stop drinking, you tell him to make his way to the home. Otherwise, what happens, and what I saw there, very, very prevalent, is as Christians, we become Christian cab drivers. And the one thing I don't do anymore, I did it a long time ago, is if I pick you up and I take you to church every Sunday, and one day I don't pick you up and I don't see you at church, then the next time I say, you're going to have to find a way to get to church. Because what's the purpose? Is it you make it so simple for me to go and go about my business without me putting any effort into it. And that's something that I have to take into consideration with whoever I'm talking to, regardless of what the subject is.
Yeah, there's a line someplace between helping somebody and enabling somebody.
Right.
If we do something for someone that they should be doing for themselves, okay, then it's enabling. But sometimes we help people because they're not able to do things for themselves. Yeah, it's two different things. You're right. Absolutely, yeah.
I'm just adding on that, I'd always find that the compassion that I've shown to alcoholic in my life seems to be used as a weapon against me. I always feel so used by that. And they take advantage of it. Each time you show compassion, they take advantage of it. I feel like I always need to have some type of education to find out what is enabling and what's not enabling.
A really good way to find out about that is go to Al-Anon.
Oh,
Al-Anon family service. It's very good. Yeah.
Codependency, Paul Brennan.
Yeah. Oh yeah.